I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. Welcome to Radio Times. In January 1973, the U.S. Supreme Court ruled on Roe v. Wade, the landmark case that made abortion legal in this country under most circumstances. It's estimated that 50 million abortions have been performed in the last 40 years. While the court's ruling was groundbreaking, abortion is by no means a settled issue. It remains one of the most divisive and contentious in this country. In recent years, states, beginning with Pennsylvania, have been passing laws to restrict and control access to abortion. Our guest, Kate Pickard, is the author of Time Magazine's cover story this week. Her article is titled, What Choice? Abortion Rights Activists won an epic victory in Roe v. Wade. They've been losing ever since. Kate Pickard is a staff writer for Time, writes about healthcare, and joins us from their studios. And Kate Pickard, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thanks for having me, Marty.
Going back 40 years and then going ahead to today, how has support for abortion waned and waxed over those 40 years?
About 75% of Americans still believe that abortion should be legal under some or all circumstances. But the sort of attitude has become more nuanced. I think that, you know, the majority of Americans, according to Gallup polling, do support regulation of abortion. So the unfettered kind of abortion on demand is really sort of gone out of fashion in terms of the majority opinion of Americans.
And is there abortion on demand in this country?
That's, of course, a loaded phrase that I just used.
Yes, it is. That's why I asked
really,
you.
Yeah, that's really, you know, pushed by the pro-life movement. I guess what I tried to do in the story is to describe the situation in which, you know, in many parts of the country, abortion is technically legal, but nearly impossible to access. I write about an abortion clinic in North Dakota that's the only clinic in the state, and there are actually four other states with just a single surgical abortion provider now. So, this idea that abortion is legal, but can you actually get it? Can you afford it? Can you, you know, afford to drive there and go through, you know, waiting period and mandatory ultrasound and many of the things that, kind of surround abortion access today has complicated the issue.
Well, would you say it's actually harder to get an abortion today than, let's say, 39 years ago?
It really depends on where you are. In New York City, where I live and where Time Magazine is, and I would imagine also, and in fact, I know, in Philadelphia and in Pennsylvania and California and other states, there aren't as many restrictions on abortion as there are in many places in the South and many rural places, and particularly red states. So it really depends on where you are geographically when thinking about how easy it is to access abortion services.
You begin your article with this clinic, the Red River Women's Clinic. It's in Fargo, North Dakota, the state's only abortion critic. And you write about a woman named Tammy Kromenaker, and basically she runs this clinic. How many years has she been running this clinic?
She's been running the clinic since it opened in 1998 in downtown Fargo.
And she describes taking a different route to work every day. How come?
Because anyone that works in the business of abortion these days really has to be mindful of the fact that a lot of people have a very hard time with what they're doing. And so the doctor that works at the Red River Women's Clinic, Tammy, and people, you know, who perform abortion services or run clinics across the country, really talk to me a lot about how they always have their guard up and they're mindful of the fact that there, of course, has been violence against abortion clinics and doctors in the past.
You also interview a number of women who went to this clinic to get an abortion. What did they tell you? Why were they there for an abortion?
A variety of reasons. One woman that is in the story told me that her birth control failed and she had wanted to do the morning after pill, but it had been too late. And she was at the Red River Women's Clinic about 6 weeks pregnant for an abortion. She felt that while she wanted children in the future, it was too soon for her. Other people, most of the people that I talked to, at least said that they had been on birth control, but it hadn't worked, and that's why they were there. Red River Women's Clinic only performs abortions up until the 16th week of pregnancy, although the vast majority of abortions are done much earlier there. And across the country, about 90% of all abortions nationwide take place in the first trimester of pregnancy.
You also describe one of the physicians talking to one of the women who was, frankly, ambivalent about having an abortion. How did that conversation go?
Between the doctor and the patient?
Yes.
Well, I wasn't in the room when she spoke to the patient, although I did interview that woman actually earlier in the day. You know, at the Red River Women's Clinic, and I imagine at many abortion clinics, it's a very supportive environment. I, of course, didn't see any, coercion or anything like that. It was a very supportive environment that was, for the women that were there, all of whom, at least amongst the ones I talked to, took very seriously what they were there for that day. The doctor at the Red River Women's Clinic and Tammy, who runs it, feel that they've dedicated their lives to supporting women. And so if that means, sometimes a patient, changes their mind or is conflicted, and in that case, they don't push them.
Right. In fact, the woman went home but then came back later and did have an abortion.
That's right.
I guess she just wanted to think her way through that difficult decision.
Yeah, and I think that I don't think it'd be right for anyone to assume that decision's not difficult for most people that do it. I think that abortion is probably never an ideal circumstance, and it's a serious thing. And by and large, all the women that I talk to at Red River, and the people who work in the field, understand the seriousness of it.
Your article is about a number of things, including the fact that we have this landmark decision by the Supreme Court, essentially giving the women the right to have an abortion, and then we have states that have instituted restrictions, frankly, beginning here in Pennsylvania with KCV Planned Parenthood.
Yeah, that's right. So KCV Planned Parenthood was a Supreme Court case, and it was decided in 1992, nearly 20 years after Roe. And what the Supreme Court said in that case is that it upheld Roe and said abortion is a constitutionally protected right, the right to privacy. But it said that states have a right to regulate abortion and to pass laws restricting the procedure or limiting it in many ways, so long as they don't present, quote, an undue, unquote, burden to women. And, pro-life activists and pro-life state legislators are kind of testing the limits of that case. And the courts are in the process of figuring out what an undue burden really is.
Well, and some examples, including a known issue here in Pennsylvania, is the size of a hallway, for instance, or whether doctors can have admitting privileges in other hospitals if they're performing abortions in a particular state. Can you talk about what some of these restrictions are?
Yeah, we sort of need to take them one by one. Right. The restriction that you hear a lot about with hallways, basically what that is, and it's most recently there was a high-profile new rule passed in Virginia related to this. Basically what happens is pro-life activists and pro-life state legislators introduce legislation basically say that abortion clinics need to be regulated like other ambulatory surgical facilities or like hospitals, which do all kinds of procedures and many things happen there that don't happen in abortion clinics. And sort of the reason that they introduce this legislation is because it's very easy to get public support to say, don't you want the abortion clinic to be as safe as the hospital? That's very easy to gain support for. And in theory, it sounds great. Who would be against safer facilities? But the truth of the matter is that, there is very little evidence that, the vast, vast majority of abortion clinics are safe places. A first trimester abortion is a fairly simple procedure, and complications are extremely rare. And as abortion services have become more concentrated in clinics as opposed to hospitals, which is another trend that's happened over the last 40 years, these clinics operate on very narrow margins, and it's very difficult for them to sometimes undertake the architectural changes that are required to comply with these new laws. And the pro-life activists know that, and that's a big part of the reason they push them.
But would you say, since the fight over abortion and Roe v. Wade continues, that those who oppose abortion have been, let's say, clever and strategic in using some of these state restrictions in order to restrict a woman's access to abortion?
Absolutely. They've been very smart. Their strategy has really paid off, and it's been effective, and it's been really well thought out. And, I talked to a lot of people in the pro-choice movement that agreed with that, that said, well, of course, they vehemently oppose the goals of the pro-life movement. They do, to some degree, admire its strategy and that how effective it's been. One woman that I spoke to that's quoted in my story, named Loretta Ross, who founded an organization called Sister Song, which works on reproductive rights for women of color, told me that she thinks that you know, the entire women's health movement, particularly in the 1970s, was predicated on a lack of gender awareness in healthcare settings. And the pro-life movement has really kind of taken that language and that message and used it for its own purposes.
In fact, part of your article is I don't know if it's a critique coming from you, but certainly coming from some people looking at, I guess, what could be called the abortion establishment. And these would be the organizations and women that grew out of the abortion rights movement, saying that things have changed and perhaps their tactics, even some of their language, no longer fits how people feel about abortion today.
And I'm generalizing here, but
sure.
Basically, you know, the legacy feminist and pro-choice organizations like NARAL Pro-Choice America, the National Organization for Women, Feminist Majority, and some others really kind of have the same messaging about a woman's right to choose, that the government doesn't have a right to interfere with a woman's healthcare decisions or her body. These are essentially the same messages that they've had for the last 40 years. And there's a growing contingent of younger people in the pro-choice activist community that really think that they believe in all of those messages, but they think that the public language and the public messaging needs to be broadened and updated to appeal to, in particular, millennial voters who are a very huge population and will make up nearly half the electorate within the next 20 years. It's important to reach those folks.
Yeah. Let me quote something from Nancy Keenan, and she was interviewed on Salon. She's stepping down as NARAL's Pro-Choice America president, and she underscores a speech that she gave in 2008 saying, "We need to acknowledge what we all know to be true today. A woman's right to choose is a morally complex issue and a lot less black and white than it's been made out to be." I mean, this is one of these legacy leaders, and she seems to be acknowledging the moral complexity of this issue.
Yeah, Nancy Keenan has acknowledged that. She's also acknowledged that she thinks that NARAL needs to be run by a younger person,
which is
one of the reasons she cited specifically for why she's stepping down. She told me that as well. I think the moral complexities of abortion are something that the pro-choice movement, you know, needs to take a hard look at and consider. Back in 1973, prenatal ultrasound was not the standard of care. It wasn't common. And of course, now it is. And that's, you know, the fact that, you know, everyone kind of knows what a fetus looks like, I think has changed and made, you know, complicated people's feelings toward abortion. I write about that and also amazing scientific advances in the field of neonatology, which mean that, you know, very premature babies now survive. And I think those two things together have, you know, as I write, complicated American attitudes toward terminating pregnancies.
Well, let's take a very short break and we'll get back to our conversation. I do want to open the lines as well. Our guest is Kate Pickert. She's a staff writer for Time, where she writes about health care. She's the author of the January 14th cover story on abortion rights and the history of Roe v. Wade. That's what we're talking about today on Radio Times. And we want to hear from you. Give us a call at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Much more to talk about after this very short break. Give us a call. We'll be right back.
The Philadelphia Orchestra supports WHYY. The Philadelphia Orchestra begins the new year with the music of Mozart. Concertmaster David Kim leads an all-Mozart program, Eine kleine Nachtmusik, the Symphony No. 25, and with Imogen Cooper, the Piano Concerto No. 24. Mozart tickets at 215-893-1999 or online. This Thursday, Friday, and Saturday at the Kimmel Center, the genius of Mozart with the Philadelphia Orchestra.
This Week on This American Life.
You know how every business has a mission statement? That's what I wanted. Like, you were Daryl Watson. You were born on this day. This is your purpose. This is how you're going to do it.
For the new year, stories of people making resolutions that are so big you can't even call them resolutions, including this guy.
I thought, why aren't more people giving away everything that they own and walking across the country?
And an entire country deciding to start over from scratch. It's This Week.
Tonight at 9 on WHYY.
President Abraham Lincoln signed the Emancipation Proclamation 150 years ago, but it didn't free all the slaves, and it didn't go over that well with a lot of people in the North either. Now, a century and a half later, there's still debate about just what it did do and why Lincoln signed it. We'll tell you more about it next time on Tell Me More.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowane. 40 years ago this month in 1973, the U.S. Supreme Court ruled on the landmark case Roe v. Wade. And while that is the law of the land, a number of states have been limiting access to abortions. For instance, state legislatures passed 92 provisions restricting abortion in 2011. Kate Pickard writes about all of this in her Time magazine cover story this week, and we are talking to her on Radio Times, and we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Kate, just picking up on what you said about how medical technology, imagery, even the issue of viability has perhaps changed people's notions or ideas about what abortion is. Does that require a different kind of law, a different kind of language in order to talk about this issue?
Well, I think one thing I do want to make clear is that the majority of Americans don't think that abortion should be outlawed and should be illegal. While people have more complicated views, I think what that means is they're more comfortable supporting state restrictions, whether that's a ballot measure or whether that's, voting for legislators in state. Who are interested in pushing these kinds of things. I just think it's really important to kind of make that point clear that basically what the pro-life movement is doing is kind of using that, public ambivalence about abortion to push for laws that they know have kind of an underlying purpose to, make it hard for, in particularly poor women and women in rural areas to access abortion.
Whether it's waiting periods or having to come back several times to a clinic in order to have an abortion, things like that?
Yeah, things like that. Waiting periods can make it difficult for people who have to travel long distances. The clinic that I went to in North Dakota is in Fargo, which is at the far eastern border of the state, and the whole rest of North Dakota, there's not a single place to get an abortion. So if a woman has to travel a great distance to get an abortion, then stay overnight in a hotel for a night or two, that makes it difficult, especially for women who don't have a lot of money. And research has shown that what that leads to is actually people getting later abortions or perhaps, in some cases not getting abortions. The overall rate of abortion in the country is down about 30% since I believe the 1980s. And as I write in the story, many people maybe, feel good about that of, fewer abortions. Isn't that a good thing? And just in general. But I think that this epitomizes the biggest challenge for the pro-choice movement is that they want to widen access to a procedure that most people feel should be restricted as rare as possible.
But I would think most people, even those who support abortion rights, believe that reducing the numbers of abortions would be a good thing. I mean, whether it means better access to contraception, better education, better technology.
Yeah, that's true. And I mean, I think, obviously a huge factor in the rate of abortion is access to affordable contraception. And that's something that the pro-choice movement has worked very hard for. Of course, the Affordable Care Act, the new health care law, provides birth control with no co-pays or co-insurance, which it's, the pro-choice movement fought hard for that. And the point of that, of course, is to, prevent unintended pregnancies in the first place.
Thinking about this, as you describe this new generation of abortion rights, I don't know if activists is the right word or organizers, what is their mission? What is their message? How do they talk about abortion?
Young abortion rights activists, they're very proud to call themselves activists, so I will.
Okay.
they don't necessarily have a different view of access to abortion. They have sort of the same kind of, I call it hard line in the story, view that abortion should not be restricted by states. So they don't necessarily have a different message on abortion specifically, but what they push for is something called reproductive justice. And this is a more holistic frame about issues related to family. So abortion is a part of that, access to contraception, access to health insurance coverage, childcare, economic opportunity. And there's definitely a sense among these young activists that their cohorts in the voting public are multi-issue voters and care about lots of issues that matter to women beyond abortion. So they've tried to really kind of broaden the frame, and they use that term reproductive justice much more frequently than the term pro-choice.
That's interesting. And that comes from this Loretta Ross, the co-founder of Sister Song.
Yeah, Loretta was one of a group of black feminists in the early 1990s who coined the term reproductive justice. And they did it in part to appeal to more women and also to speak to the needs of women of color. Abortion is a much more complicated issue than many people realize. And the abortion rate among black women in the U.S. is about 3.5 times as high as white women. And so providing more access to abortion sort of doesn't get at sort of the reasons behind that and maybe what things are lacking in terms of services, education, economic opportunity for some of those communities. So this is something that Loretta and many other black feminists have been talking about for a long time, and that message has really been adopted by a lot of young white feminists now, that sort of that term and kind of that broader, more complex message.
Well, let me get some callers in on the conversation. And that phone number is 1-888-477-9499. Talking with Kate Picker today about her Time magazine cover story, looking at Roe v. Wade passed 40 years ago this month, looking at Roe v. Wade then and now, and this very contentious and complex and conflicted, I think, view of abortion. And we're taking calls. Let's see what Mina from Jenkintown has to say. And Mina, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Yes. Can you hear me okay?
Yes, I can. Go ahead.
Okay. Your guest had referenced people within the pro-life movement and used the term, you know, their agenda. And obviously, you know, pro-choice is pro-Roe versus Wade and pro-life is not pro-versus Roe versus Wade. But my question to your guest is, what exactly does she identify as the pro-life, quote-unquote, agenda that she referenced earlier? And additionally to that, if she feels that there's any profit driven motive to that agenda.
Okay, fair enough. Mina, thanks for the call to Radio Times. Kate, can, and I realize you're a journalist here, so you don't represent either side of this issue, but how do you see this agenda, I guess, from those who oppose abortion?
Yeah, so, you know, even to use the terms pro-life movement, pro-choice movement, those are huge generalizations. But, you know, when I talk about the pro-life kind of establishment, I would say that their agenda is first and foremost to try to overturn Roe. So they are specifically kind of picking legal fights within the states and state courts and in district federal courts in the hopes that eventually an abortion case will land before a Supreme Court that may have a different makeup than it does now and may be more sympathetic to their views and may overturn Roe. So that's, you know, their number one goal. And I think I talked to Charmaine Yost, who's the head of Americans United for Life, which is a big pro-life group. And she said that the state strategy that she and her fellow activists are pursuing is meant to kind of leapfrog or work around Roe. So their hope is that they can severely or in some cases perhaps completely curtail access to abortion at the state level if they can't overturn Roe. So I'd say that's their agenda. As far as a profit motive, I'm not sure what the caller's thinking of, but I'm not sure
either. But no, fair enough. Let me just pick up on that because I'm actually going back to the election of 2012 when we heard Murdoch, Aiken, two who were running for Congress talking about no exception for rape, the idea that if a woman gets raped, there's something that's going to shut that whole thing down. That was a quote there. The opposition to contraception, the opposition to morning after pills, the idea of giving citizenship to a fertilized egg. Do you think this helps the cause?
I think that when things like Todd Aiken and Murdoch happen, I think that that's great for the pro-choice cause. I think it helps with their fundraising. I think it gets a lot of women who may be offended by those things kind of mobilized. But as I write in the story, abortion access is something that is the purview of states. And so what happens federally in Congress or the re-election of Barack Obama doesn't really have a lot to do with how easy it is to access this service. In Indiana, where Murdoch was defeated, the Democrat that beat him is also pro-life. Voters in that state also elected Mike Pence, the new governor. He's a conservative congressman that has really led the fight in Congress to defund Planned Parenthood. So the idea that Indiana voters took a stand for women's reproductive rights is sort of difficult to square with some of those other electoral outcomes.
Let me get back to our callers at 1-888-477-9499. And we have Bob from Westchester joining us on Radio Times. Bob, go ahead. You're on the air.
Yes. Hi, Marnie.
Hi there.
Thanks for talking to you this morning.
Thank you.
I just wanted to voice my opinion, and that is that my wife and I have had a number of children, both male and female. I think it's outrageous that any man should tell a woman what she can be able to do with her body. I think it's outrageous that another person that is not even related to the family can have a say in what she has to live with for the rest of her life. It's kind of unique that this happens in America. After listening to your show this morning about what's happening in India and other places in the world, that we have this same kind of discrimination here in America in this day and age. And I also find it interesting that males are perpetrating on females that they can't use birth control and other methods of controlling their own lives.
Well, Bob, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. Kate Pickard, anything you want to add to that? That certainly is a very strong perspective.
One thing that I did want to mention, actually, is that abortion is something that touches a lot of women. According to the Guttmacher Institute, which is a reproductive rights group, but their statistics are believed to be very good, and they're cited by people on both sides of the issue. According to their research, about 30% of women will have an abortion by the time they reach age 45. So I think this, I think a lot of times people don't talk about the fact that they've had abortions, although the pro-choice movement certainly wishes more people would to destigmatize the procedure. But it's a really, it's a staggeringly common thing that I think a lot of people aren't aware of. So I just wanted to mention that.
Yeah, fair enough. Bob, thanks for the call to Radio Times. Again, you can call 1-888-477-9499. Going back to these young feminists, and I hate to use this, young and old language, but nonetheless, I think there is an interesting generational, perhaps, difference on this issue. But you write about the use of things like Twitter and perhaps not wanting to be told by someone your mother's or grandmother's age about how you're supposed to live your life. Can you speak to that?
Yeah, I think the internet and social media in particular has decentralized power in a lot of activist movements. I think that goes beyond abortion as an issue. I think it's true in immigration and lots of other divisive, modern issues in America. I think many of the young activists that I talk to, they want some power in the pro-choice movement. And if they can't get it at some of these legacy organizations, they're going to try to get it for themselves on Twitter, by blogging, on the web. And so a lot of women, young activists, are just deciding that they're going to do this. They're going to try to organize, and they're going to sort of speak up online. The problem with that, or sort of the limit of that, is that a lot of these legacy feminist organizations have been the power centers for voter mobilization efforts, lobbying, fundraising, and those are really important things for any political cause. And so a lot of young activists, kind of in a disparate way, saying things on Twitter or blogging, I think there's a question of whether that could have the same impact that some of these older, more experienced legacy organization types can.
I mean, is it the unwillingness or inability for whatever reason to so-called pass the torch to that next generation, feeling, they didn't live through what we lived through, and do they really understand the importance of this issue and what might happen if we lost this constitutional right?
I think it's important to say that experience is a good thing. It can help someone be a better leader. So I think they believe that. I think also a lot of the women that run these legacy organizations, and a lot of women, not Tammy Cromanacre, she's in her 40s, but a lot of the abortion clinics around the country actually were started shortly after Roe, and a lot of the same people are still running them as well. And I think what they feel is something that a lot of pro-choice leaders feel, which is a lot of ownership over the right to have an abortion, over the movement. And I think sort of letting that go has been difficult. Yeah, I think that's true.
And maybe saying, you didn't live when we lived, at a time when we lived, and you don't understand what this issue is really all about.
Yeah, I mean, you know, the young activist that I wrote about in the story, grew up in a Roe, post-Roe world. And so there's some thinking that, you know, young people kind of take it for granted, this right, access to abortion, and that, you know, older folks that were around when there were back alley abortions and when things were unsafe before Roe have a sort of a more complex and more educated, perhaps, understanding of the issue.
Were you born in 1970? Were you alive in 1973?
I was not. I grew up in a post-Roe world myself.
You did as well. I wonder whether this is, you know, you see this in other movements where it started by one generation, it's carried on by next generation, but the difficulty sometimes of making that handoff to the younger set can be a challenge, I think, for any organization.
I think that that's true. I'm sure this is happening in other activist movements. You know, generational tension over strategy, messaging, you know, I'm sure occurs in a lot of other movements as well. One thing that a lot of the young activists said, I remember this one activist saying, I don't want to work for an organization that just thinks I know how to run their Twitter feed. I could do a lot more than that. And my, you know, virtue and my value extends beyond, you know, knowing how to use an iPod and social media. She said something like that. So, you know, the millennial generation and these young activists, they really believe that they can have a strong influence and they want a big piece of the power pie in the abortion rights activist movement.
Let me see what Dale from Center City, Philadelphia has to say. Dale, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Sure. Hi. I've been in the reproductive health care movement for more than 30 years, so I'm part of the old guard. Not ready to move over yet. I guess that's when people tell me I'm not effective anymore. But, you know, I just want to take a little bit of exception because we've made a significant investment in language and messaging over the years, and both Planned Parenthood has and Reproductive Health Technology Project has, and we knew the old labels didn't resonate with young people or with others. Pro-choice and pro-life labels don't really reflect the conversation that's having in America today. But we found that the message that government and politicians should not interfere in women's intensely personal decisions polls actually really well with young people and with all age groups. And our strongest message now is that abortion is deeply personal and an often complex decision for women, and you can't make that decision for someone else. You don't walk in her shoes. So I just wanted to say we really have paid attention to language. And we know that the old labels don't work anymore, and we've worked really hard to change that.
Dale, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. Kate, you want to add to that or respond to that?
Yeah, I just wanted to say two things. One on this idea, the message that abortion is an intensely personal decision. Actually, in the among young activists, there's some debate over whether that's a good message. Abortion is really a stigmatized thing, despite the fact that 30% of women have abortions. And so there's kind of a movement online and on social media, especially among young activists, to encourage young women to come and tell their abortion stories and to be public about it as a way of kind of destigmatizing it. So a lot of young activists see this messaging of abortion is a personal private decision as something that perhaps connotes some kind of shame that they think hinders kind of the movement. And as far as, you know, the movement kind of updating its messaging strategy, yes, I mean, that has happened. Leaders in the pro-choice movement know what's been happening on the ground, but what's been happening on the ground has been happening. And so regardless of how they've tried to update their messaging, they're somehow not able to punch through because these abortion restrictions are still being put in place more and more every year, making it harder to access the service that's technically a federal right.
Well, Kate Picker, thank you for joining us today on Radio Times.
Thanks so much for having me.
You're welcome. She's a staff writer for Time Magazine, where she writes about healthcare, author of the January 14th cover story on Roe v. Wade. We have another guest waiting in the wings, and we're taking more calls at 1-888-477-9499. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Montgomery School, an independent co-ed day school for pre-K through grade 8, supports WHYY. Montgomery School believes that when children find joy in learning, they are forever inspired to explore their world and are best prepared to succeed in their educational pursuits and beyond. An open house will be held on their Chester Springs campus Saturday, January 12th at 10 a.m. Details at montgomeryschool.org. Montgomery School, inspired to explore, prepared to succeed. Montgomery School supports WHYY.
On the next Fresh Air, Bobby Cannavale. He's starring opposite Al Pacino in the Broadway revival of Glengarry Glen Ross. On HBO's Boardwalk Empire, he played the sadistic and masochistic gangster Gyp Rossetti, who Cannavale describes as needing to feel stimulated all the time.
And so he does that by making a joke that scares somebody that doesn't know it's a joke.
Join us.
This afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 on WHYY.
I'm Robin Young. Join us next time for the news and these stories here and now. A lot of cheese is stored in caves. Kraft keeps its cheese in a mine in Missouri. We'll explore the network of massive refrigerators that keep our food fresh from farm to fridge. Also, the critic's darling, indie band Yola Tengo. That's Public Radio's Daily Digest of News and Culture here and now.
Today at noon on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowena. I just said goodbye to Time Magazine's journalist Kate Pickard, talking about her battle her article over the continuing battle over abortion. That's 40 years after Roe v. Wade. Joining us now is Ada Calhoun. She's a freelance journalist, author of The Rise of DIY Abortions. That's the cover story of the December 31st edition of The New Republic. Her most recent book is Instinctive Parenting, Trusting Ourselves to Raise Good Kids. And Ada Calhoun, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thanks so much for having me.
You're welcome. How common are what you call or others call DIY abortions?
There aren't any hard numbers. It's very hard to determine how many women are doing this. But in the course of researching the story, I just came across tons of anecdotal reports and then also just this proliferation of websites offering abortion pills on the Internet.
Your article begins, frankly, with a really sad and I have to say, in many ways, horrifying story about a young woman who, frankly, was arrested for having a DIY abortion. Help us understand what she did and what happened to her.
Jenny Lynn McCormick is a 33-year-old divorced mother of three in Idaho, and she found herself pregnant a couple of years ago, and she had no access, really, to a legal abortion. She was poor. She had, these three kids. She had no car. Her boyfriend was in jail, and so what she did was she called her sister, who had a computer, and she asked her to order abortion pills for her online. Mm. And the sister did this. The whole thing took a couple of months. So she thought she was actually in week 14 at that point. And then she took the pills when they arrived, which was the day before Christmas Eve. And she wound up delivering on Christmas Eve day a dead fetus in her bathroom. Mm. And it was much bigger than she thought it would be.
Obviously, meaning a much older fetus than she thought it was as well.
Yeah, it was probably between 19 and 23 weeks.
Oh, wow. Yeah. And she was by herself.
She was alone. Yeah, she was alone. And she, you know, she had hidden the pregnancy from everybody. She hadn't told anybody but her sister. And, you know, one of the things that I found sort of most heartbreaking about it was she continued to kind of go about the business of, you know, being a mother to these other children. And she, you know, did Christmas Eve dinner and she wrapped the presents and she did the whole thing. And meanwhile, she didn't know what to do with this aborted fetus and she hid it under her bed. And she kept it there for some time, for about a week. And then she moved it onto the back porch, and she didn't know what to do. She wanted to bury it, but she panicked, basically.
And she was arrested.
And yes, and then about 2 weeks later, she confessed to a friend, and the friend called his sister, and the sister called the police. And then the police arrived in January, and she, you know, basically she opened the door and she said, "My baby's in the box."
Mm. She was arrested. Was she arrested for murder?
She was not arrested for murder. She was arrested under an Idaho law that basically says that you can't have an abortion except as prescribed by the state. Mm. So it was basically she was charged with an illegal abortion.
An abortion that she had done to herself.
That's right. That's right.
Why did it take, as you said, she ordered these anti-abortion, whatever.
Mm-hmm.
Online.
Why
did it take Why did it take several months for that to arrive?
From my impression is that a lot of the websites are not incredibly reliable. Some of them say that they have Mifeprex, which is, you know, what a lot of us know as RU486. And in fact, they are giving out Cytotec, which is another abortion pill that's also, you know, quite effective, but it's not the same thing. You know, some of them are just, giving out aspirin or, you know, other pills that are not at all going to work. Other, you know, sites just never send anything, and other ones take a long time.
You describe, I guess, some of the come-ons of these sites, what they're promising to these women looking for something to end their pregnancy.
Yeah, yeah.
Very disturbing.
No, and some of the slogans are, you know, they're so chilling. It's like, you know, right here, right now. It's also like Viagra talk almost, you know, online of, 100% effective, save hundreds. It's kind of like, it's sort of like a nightmare scenario.
I have to say it was a very disturbing article to read for a whole host of reasons. What happened to this woman? She was arrested.
So she was charged by the state. She didn't actually do jail time. She wound up lucking into this kind of an incredible lawyer who was part of the biggest law firm in Pocatello, and she called him for help with her criminal defense, and he got her off because there was no real evidence. These abortions with these pills basically look the same as a miscarriage, and the police didn't have anything except for her statement. So he got her off of the charge, and then he sued the prosecutor. He said, you know, that you can't go after women for this. And the district court agreed, and the circuit court not only agreed, but had this kind of, sweeping 37-page decision saying, it's become so hard for women to have a legal abortion in places like southeastern Idaho that, you know, to charge them then with having an illegal one is just not fair.
She was also, for a time, shunned by her community. I mean, everyone knew what she had done.
She definitely feels very, very persecuted. The newspaper did run her home address and her age, and apparently she says that really what's bothered her the most is people saying things to her kids at school.
Is that still going on, or has that?
She says it is. I mean, it stayed in the news because the court cases continue to go on, and now they're waiting for another decision because it's gone back to the district court. What happened at the circuit court is that they said you can't prosecute her, but they didn't broaden the injunction, so other women can still be arrested for having illegal abortions.
Let me reintroduce you. That's Ada Calhoun. She's a freelance journalist, author of an article called The Rise of DIY Abortions. It was the cover story of the December 31st issue of The New Republic. Her most recent book is called Instinctive Parenting, Trusting Ourselves to Raise Good Kids. Any questions or comments that you might have, do give us a call at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. We began our show with a conversation with Kate Pickard. Time magazine cover story is about the numbers of states that do have these restrictions restricting women's access to abortion. Do you see then the rise of DIY as a response to this?
Very much so. And I spoke with one woman who didn't actually make it into the story, but who is sort of like an online provider, sort of self-appointed on Yahoo Answers. And she says, you know, since the restrictions have gone into effect, she's seen a huge rise in the number of women approaching her online for advice on how to end their pregnancies at home.
Which means that they're not under doctor's care.
Right.
That we, you know, that's obvious anyway.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but one thing that I was surprised by is that actually, you know, there isn't a real comparison to the back alley of pre-Roe in that these pills are quite safe, especially if they're used in the first 9 weeks, and you get the right thing, and it's not, you know, one of these sort of scam sites.
Right.
A lot of doctors I spoke to said that for them, this is really the sort of, it seems kind of crazy that they're not more accessible because they're so safe. They're safer than Viagra. And yet, you know, Mifeprex is one of the most highly guarded drugs in the country.
And Mifeprex is RU486.
That's right.
And there's another drug that you also write about, Cytotec?
Cytotec, which is an ulcer medication, but it also happens to be very effective in ending pregnancy. It's available over-the-counter in Mexico. So that's a lot more easy for women to get a hold of online or, you know, in these other countries.
Are there questions about having a prescription for these kinds of drugs? I mean, obviously, if you went to a drugstore, you would need a prescription, wouldn't you?
Well, Mifeprex isn't even available by prescription. You actually have to take it in a clinical setting. Like, there's only one distributor, and the doctors have to register with that distributor to get it, and there are just extremely tight controls on it. Cytotec, you do need a prescription for.
But you can get it online?
Yeah, I mean, you can get Mifeprex, too, in some places online. You know, not legally, of course.
Well, let me see what Joe from Bluebell has to say. And Joe, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Yes, I'm very disturbed by this discussion that there's been no real consideration given to the right to life of the infant. I mean, all this discussion has been about the women's rights to what you're calling a medical procedure, mm-hmm. when serious consideration should be given to the fact that abortion is a termination of a human life. I mean, where are the consciences of these women when they don't protect their own infants? And the reason why abortions have gone down recently, one of the reasons, is because of the ultrasound procedure, when women are actually seeing the formation of an entire human being in their womb. And then they make the decision not to have an abortion. That's one of the reasons. I'm disturbed with the fact that none of your guests have discussed that.
Well, actually, we did. Kate Pickard and I were talking about the fact that through medical technology, imagery, that has been an important influence in how people think about this particular issue. I appreciate the call, Joe, but we did actually discuss that. But I'd be curious, Ada Calhoun, how you think about that.
Well, you know, I talk in the piece about the, you know, reaction of the police on finding the body of the fetus, and they were very upset by it. I mean, they were sort of visibly upset when I talked to them about it. You know, I think that that's obviously why this is such a hard question for everybody and such a hard topic to talk about, is because, of course, you know, of course there are two very strong considerations when we talk about abortion. You know, and one is the mother and one is the baby.
Joe, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. You can call as well, 1-888-477-9499. As I said, reading your article was frankly very disturbing. What do you want people to take away from it?
I guess the main thing is just how hard it is for women in places like Southeast Idaho to access a legal abortion, and how it's very likely that they are, in fact, accessing illegal abortions online now as a response. So, you know, the last caller mentioned that abortion has gone down, and the official numbers show that, yes, it has. Right. But, you know, there are a lot of numbers we don't have, which is, you know, how many women are getting these drugs illegally. And my impression, having reported the story, is that that number is actually rising.
In response to the fact that in certain places in this country, it's difficult to have an abortion?
Yeah, it's almost impossible. And for women like Daniela McCormick, I mean, here she is. She has no resources. The nearest place is several hours away, mm-hmm. And there's a 72-hour waiting period, you know, and it would cost between, like, $400 and $2,000, mm-hmm. and she has these children she has to take care of. She had no way to have a legal procedure.
Having looked at this issue from this perspective, do you see, as you look into your crystal ball, if I can say that, I mean, do you see a point where there could be some consensus or more consensus on this issue of abortion, whether it has to do with things like contraception or education, something that a majority of people can not just agree on, but be able to talk about in some kind of rational way?
You know, I would hope so. I mean, I think everybody can basically agree that this Daniela McCormick story is just horrific, and that I don't think anybody wants, you know, that kind of scenario. So I feel like if she had better access to information, contraception, you know, it seems like it would never have gotten to that point. You know, and a lot of the activists I've talked to say the sort of new front is access to these abortion pills, which are very safe. And if used in the first few weeks of pregnancy, they resemble a spontaneous abortion. I mean, it's a spontaneous miscarriage. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like a heavy period, and it's not this kind of trauma that she went through.
It's interesting talking to someone who also wrote a book called Instinctive Parenting, Trusting ourselves to Raise Good Kids.
One thing that I was sort of struck by, and this, again, is not like an advocacy piece. I'm not arguing for anybody. I'm just sort of was trying to tell this woman's story, which I think everybody agrees is just, you know, is not desirable. But, you know, most of the women, from what I've heard, who have abortions have already had children, and I think they sort of recognize how valuable, you know, being a good parent is. Mm. It's a very tough decision, a very tough thing to talk about.
Well, and also, it seems like for and perhaps this is not a surprise, but for poor women, it is harder for them to have this procedure.
It really is. It's like, and that's one of the numbers that I was surprised by, is just how much abortion has actually grown within the community of poor women. It's way higher, and I think part of that is education, and you know, which is decreasing everywhere, it seems like.
What's been the response to your article? I'm curious about that.
I've it's actually been pretty positive. I mean, people basically have the same reaction you did of just, right, it's really creepy, yeah. You know, and it's just very disturbing. But, you know, I've also heard from, like, I heard from one woman yesterday who works with abortion access, and she said that she was happy to see those drugs represented as safe, because I think there's a lot of fear around them still, and a lot of stigma around them, when actually, you know, women who work with them and doctors who work with them say that they are remarkably effective and safe.
Well, on that note, Ada Calhoun, thank you for joining us today on Radio Times.
Thanks for having me.
You're welcome. She's a freelance journalist, author of The Rise of DIY Abortions. That was the cover story of the December 31st issue of The New Republic. Again, her most recent book is called Instinctive Parenting, Trusting Ourselves to Raise Good Kids. We began our conversation with Kate Pickard, staff writer for Time Magazine, where she writes about healthcare, and she is the cover story in this week's edition of Time. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes to find out more about this program. I'm Marty Moscoen. Thank you so much for joining us. Do stay with us. We'll be right back.
Kings Island Gold Pass is your ticket to unlimited visits this year and all through 2025. Make the park your own with access to 2 years of tricks and treats, Halloween Haunt, and Winterfest, plus an expanded Soak City featuring the all-new dual racing water coaster River Racers coming in 2025. All for our lowest price of the season. Just 10 payments of $9 after initial payment plus applicable taxes and fees. Hurry, price goes up September 3rd. Get your Gold Pass at visitkingsisland.com.